Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Friday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Our martinis are a little bit out of order today, but we still have a good. We definitely still have a bad. And we're going to start off with one that we're not sure whether it's good or bad yet, but it's probably the biggest news of the day, so we figured we'd start there first. And, Jim, that was the news revealed by actually the South Koreans at the White House yesterday evening, that, in fact, President Trump has agreed to meet face-to-face with Kim Jong-un, the North Korean dictator. This is something that has never happened, a U.S. president meeting with a North Korean leader, but it's going to happen by the time May gets here. So either this month or probably more likely next month, these two are going to meet face-to-face. We don't know the details yet. You lead off the jolt with this today by bullet-pointing some of the good possibilities here. Obviously, if the North Koreans are in any way genuine about stopping their nuclear testing while the talks play out, or even better, denuclearizing, that would obviously be huge. You point out that some experts think even just a ratcheting down of the missile program would be a good thing. The downside, of course, is that North Korea could just be playing us, and that Trump is very eager to make deals, and he might end up making a bad deal. My gut reaction here is that the North Koreans are following the Iranian playbook. They're starting to feel the pinch of the sanctions, and they think they can get some relief by making some promises to the United States, and then therefore buying themselves more time and getting some financial relief. So what's your hunch on this? The Trump supporters are basically making him out to be Churchill. Even some of the left are saying this could be monumental. What's your takeaway here?
You know, Greg, this is one of the reasons where the instantaneous reaction nature of the news cycle and cable news need to have the Rock'em Sock'em robots, left versus right, red versus blue, probably will obscure more than it will illuminate. It's too early to say. It's too hard to it's kind of hard to tell. This could be a very good development, as you mentioned, depending on how serious the North Koreans are about this and how serious they are about denuclearization. The fact that at least they say they're not going to do any more nuclear tests or launch any more intercontinental ballistic missile tests while this process is going on is a good sign. In some ways, that does represent something of a concession from them right off the bat. I do point out that, you know, I think it was, you know, former CIA and NSA director Michael Hayden who said on Twitter last night, "I just have a feeling we're going to get a sword dance out of this." And he's thinking, I assume, of the Saudi Arabians who welcomed President Trump early in his presidency with this elaborate welcome ceremony and the sword dance and everything else like that. Trump can be susceptible to flattery. If he liked the French military parade, Greg, you can only imagine how he'll react when he sees a North Korean one. At this point, it's not clear where this summit is going to occur. Apparently, there's even discussions of it occurring, an invitation to Kim Jong-un to go to Washington. It was 2007, 2008 that almost every Republican was pointing to Barack Obama, who had answered a question in a Democratic presidential debate by saying that, yes, he was willing to meet without preconditions with the leaders of North Korea and Iran and Cuba and Venezuela and Syria. And there might have been one or two others in there. And it was just this added, we thought this was unbelievably naive, unbelievably foolish. Basically, you're giving this hostile foreign state exactly what it wants, the status and the glamour of a meeting with the U.S. president. A meeting with the U.S. president is a big deal. We don't know, you know, our allies sometimes have to wait a few years to get a, you know, official visit from a U.S. president or a summit or something like that. So on the one hand, Kim Jong-un and North Korea are getting something they want from this process. Now, if this ends up with denuclearization, giving them something like this is worth it. Or at least I think it is. I think most people would say this. I think this should be stirring a really serious discussion in the United States foreign policy circles, both inside and outside of government. What do we really want from North Korea? I would think the number one priority is the denuclearization. We want them not having nuclear weapons. Fair to ask, do we want to get rid of the regime? I think obviously we would like to. We'd like to have a day where the North Korean citizens or really subjects are you know, freed from that prison camp of a country and can breathe the air of freedom and pursue their lives, and they're not living under despotism. On the other hand, we know that system is not going to go away anytime soon. We want to preserve the peace on the Korean Peninsula. So the question is, you know, what concessions are worth it? Are trade sanctions worth it? On National Review Online today, an expert from the University of Illinois says, you know, maybe it's time to talk about we'd be willing to pull out U.S. troops from South Korea if they if they were willing to denuclearize. Now, obviously, any denuclearization would have to require inspections. And we've been through this game before with Saddam Hussein and the Iraqis. This is a big bone of contention in the Iran deal, in our sense that if you don't have free inspections and full inspections whenever the IAEA or outside groups want, well, then you can be secretly developing your nuclear program behind closed doors. And, oh, by the way, that's exactly what the North Koreans did back in the 1990s. So this is a very risky move by the president. I put myself in my favorite metaphor of Fox Mulder's poster on his wall in the X-Files that said, I want to believe. I want to believe this is going to work out, but that's not the same thing as saying I believe.
I like the fact that Trump says the sanctions will stay until there's actually a deal. You point out in the jolt that the joint military exercises with South Korea will continue. So it's not like we're all of a sudden just going to change policy due to the fact that we might actually have a conversation here. So let's move to our bad martini now, Jim. Let's go to hot air with a lot of help from the Miami Herald here. Deputy Scott Peterson is the armed Broward County Sheriff's deputy who remained outside Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School during the shooting last month. Peterson was heavily criticized for his inaction and through his lawyer released a statement saying he believed those gunshots were originating from outside any of the buildings on the school campus, which is why he never entered the building. But today, meaning yesterday, the Miami Herald reports that audio recordings of police dispatch indicate Peterson knew almost right away that the shots were coming from a specific building. Miami Herald. Internal radio dispatches released by the sheriff's office Thursday show Peterson immediately fixated on Building 12 and even radioed that gunfire was happening inside. And just as school shooter Nicholas Cruz was fleeing the building after killing 17 people, Peterson warned his fellow officers to stay away even as wounded students and staff lay inside. The Herald then puts together a brief timeline here. Cruz was dropped off at the school by an Uber at 2:19. 2 minutes later, he enters Building 12 and began firing within 15 seconds. Peterson at that time was near the administration building. At 2:22, the fire alarm was pulled, blaring throughout the entire campus. The first 911 call also went out via Coral Springs Emergency Dispatch Center. Quote, be advised, we have possible, could be firecrackers. I think we have shots fired, possible shots fired, 1200 building. Peterson radioed at 2:23. At that moment, according to the video, Peterson arrived at the southeast corner of Building 12, where he appeared to remain for the duration of the incident. At 2:27 p.m., 6 minutes after Cruz went into Building 12, the shooting stopped, Cruz ditched his AR-15 in the third floor stairwell and left. 5 seconds later, Peterson radioed for officers, quote, to stay at least 500 feet away at this point. A dispatcher repeated, stay away from 12 and 1300 buildings. So, Jim, the facts are clearly not on his side in his explanation for why he refused to confront this gunman. And I know this is a tired refrain in all these developments that we're learning about here, but the more we learn about this story, the more horrific it is.
Absolutely true, Greg. And I'm kind of left with this thought. Hey, look, apparently the Broward Sheriff's Office is relenting. At one point, they had said they did not want to see the videotape released. Now they're coming around and they've asked a judge. They've, you know, basically say, okay, there are certain legal exemptions that block this. Greg, if like within a day or two of this shooting, we had seen video of the officer taking his position behind a column or whatever it was and not rushing in. And presumably we'd either have video of that and or with the radio traffic, we'd be able to hear his words and, you know, perhaps even the sound of the gunshots. Do you think the conversation after the shooting would focus so much on gun control? My suspicion is not. My suspicion is this would be a very different conversation that would be based almost entirely on police responsibility, on police procedure in potential mass shootings and things like that, police training about how to handle situations like this. The argument might be, we've seen a little bit of the discussion about arming teachers. If the police come to a violent crisis in which people are being shot not far from them and refuse to take action, well, then by golly, why wouldn't you want armed citizens intervening? I mean, it's the idea of disarming the public would seem even more asinine when the one force that has the legal authority to use deadly force in a situation like that refuses to do so. I think this could have been a very different discussion. Now, I don't know whether the law, you know, maybe Florida's legislature still would have passed that law. I think it's very safe to say also that CNN town hall would have progressed very, very differently if we'd had that video released fairly quickly. Now, obviously, look, after a massive crime like this, there are procedures and things like that. But look, we didn't hear any of this for the first 5 days after the shooting, 6 days, Greg. They let the national conversation go in a certain direction before this occurred. Now, thankfully, the Miami Herald and various other news organizations are basically still holding them to account. I think it's safe to say that Sheriff Israel's name is mud. I do think it's interesting that right after he had made his initial statement that one officer did not go in, since then we've heard the idea that there are at least four officers on scene who did not go in. There was at least one victim who had said that it was about a half hour between when she was shot to when she saw anybody in police, the SWAT team entering. I'm kind of left wondering, when all this came out, the lawyer for the officer said that he was being railroaded, that he was being used as a scapegoat, and that he looked forward to giving his side of the story. Greg, I don't know about you. I really want to hear this guy's side of the story. I want to hear his explanation as to why he's telling everybody to stay 500 feet back instead of engaging with a mass shooter as he's rampaging through a school. I want to hear from him because my suspicion is there is no good explanation. There is no way to justify his inaction. This was a total failure of duty on his part, and one that may have been facilitated by a irresponsible culture in this sheriff's office. We talked about the report of some other officer who told everyone else to establish a perimeter,
right,
which was, again, not police procedure when you're dealing with a mass shooter. So I suppose there's a silver line to all this. So there is a belated sense of accountability to this police force. But otherwise, it represents just a hideous failure of some of the most vulnerable citizens in this country, and kind of appalling, and the sort of thing that really should be shaping more of our discussion than some of the demagoguery we've seen since that shooting.
Well, on to our third martini, and it's not very often that we close with the good news, but I feel like today we need to close with good news. This is courtesy of CNN, but obviously a lot of people are reporting this. American businesses are on a hiring spree. The U.S. economy added 313,000 jobs in February. That was much stronger than economists expected and the biggest gain since July 2016, according to Labor Department figures published Friday. The unemployment rate stayed at 4.1%, the lowest in 17 years. Wages grew 2.6% compared with the year earlier, a few notches below the pace in January. That delighted investors. The Dow was set to open up more than 150 points. More modest wage growth cools fears about inflation and rising U.S. interest rates, both of which spooked the markets last month. In the first 2 months of the year, the United States has already added more than 500,000 jobs, and job gains for December and January were both revised higher. So, Jim, you always like to see reports like that. Hopefully we can keep it going. Not sure if tariffs will help or hurt that. Probably hurt it in the long run, but in some sectors it might boost things. There's reports of at least one company that's planning to reopen a plant and hire a few hundred workers. So we'll see. But in the end, right now, the economy still seems to be humming.
It's also worth noting that the previous month's numbers adjusted upward, which is a nice thing to see. 15,000 December, 39,000 in January, which is, strikes me as, hey, we missed about 40,000 people getting hired. Kind of a big miss. It's always good to find out the news is better than you expected, than worse. Also kind of worth noting, I kind of feel like this is something of a vindication for the tax cuts. We all recall that Nancy Pelosi said that this was Armageddon, and of course it's not. I do kind of wonder if obviously the significant number to see unemployment rate among African Americans, 6.9%. That's a record low or further moving in the right direction. Also kind of an interesting thing. I have a feeling, Greg, that 4.1% is a nice, happy number. People are happy to see it. I have a feeling if at any point in the next before now and the end of the year, if at some point unemployment reaches 3.9%, and maybe that's an unrealistic goal, maybe we're never quite going to reach it. Maybe the rate of job creation and the number of new people entering the workforce will always balance out or something like that. But if you could actually, I think that'd be a major psychological barrier, that if it hits 3.9%, you'd really see people, economic confidence going, wow, we really have reached about as close to full employment as you can possibly imagine. Now, look, this is after a long stretch of, the Great Recession, unemployment reaching 9, 10%, much higher in certain parts of the country. But I really feel like that would be, break out the party hats. This is about as good as it possibly can get. So look, for the administration, this is really good news. You and I talked about the tariffs earlier in the week and the possibility that this is going to be a obstacle. If you're a steel company, you probably are like, oh, great. Okay, now, it's more expensive to buy steel and aluminum from foreign producers, so people will have to buy more of our stuff. Never mind the fact that they're only producing about 70% of what the country needs. If you're Hershey needing to make aluminum foil, if you're a car maker using steel or something like that, all of a sudden this doesn't seem so good. All of a sudden you're going to have to pay more to get your supplies of steel and aluminum, and chances are you're going to pass that along to consumers. And all those consumers who are enjoying more money with their tax cut, all of a sudden they find themselves back to square one again. So a little bit of an ominous point on the horizon. But for now, it's a really good jobs report. And this administration should celebrate its victories when they come like this.
Plus 300,000 jobs. Fantastic way to end the week. Jim, have a great weekend. We'll talk to you Monday.
See you Monday, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today. Have a great weekend, everyone. And tune in again Monday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.